Normally, I have a lead-in for these things, but really, I think all I need to say is Jank is adorable. And with that, I am pleased to welcome to the lounge Todd Nicholas.
Do you want to know what it actually says? You're not the first person to think it's saying Jank is adorable. You want to know what it is?
Oh, what is it?
It's Jank is a dork word.
Jank is a dork word? I never knew that.
It was from the very first episode, which I don't even think we have. I don't even think we've made available. Or this is why people get it wrong. The very first episode, Lex and John Kelly were talking on it, and one of them says, I think it's one of them says, you know, what does Jank mean? And Lex's answer is Jank is a dork word. When I wrote the theme song, I was looking for something to just kind of drop in the beginning, since we didn't have any vocals for it, and that was what I picked. And most people, when they say it, they think it says Jank is adorable, because I don't know why you would think Jank is a dork word. It totally sounds like Jank is adorable. But yeah, that's what it's saying. Jank is a dork word.
Now I will never hear it as Jank is adorable again. It'll always be Jank is a dork word.
You will hear it correctly now. Yeah. It's funny to me how many people have said that. Like, people have come and said, what does Jank is adorable mean? Not that Jank is a dork word makes a lot more sense, but it makes some sense.
Yeah, I mean, at least it's got a story behind it, right? Like, it's like a talking point for the Jank cast. Like, that's totally not what it meant.
So thank you for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. So, Todd, in an effort to let some of the listeners get to know you, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're studying sociology and have a master's or a PhD in that field?
I have a PhD, yeah. I have a PhD, and I am a professor of sociology. So, yeah, I had a bit of an interesting trajectory. I've kind of been across the country a couple times now. I got my PhD in 2013 in sociology. My areas of interest are religion and politics, so the two things you're not supposed to talk about, apparently. Hmm. But I was what was called a visiting assistant professor for a while, which is where you are a temporary professor out on the West Coast. And then I got a job as an assistant professor in the South. And now I will be moving back to Illinois, where I'm originally from Chicagoland. That's where the Jank cast is based out of. So I've been kind of doing the cast remotely from first West Coast and now the South. And hopefully this job is now permanent. The job I have here is permanent, but when this job in Illinois came up, it was too good to pass up. It's a school I'm really interested in teaching at, and it's nearby where I grew up, so it's kind of cool to be back there. I'll be able to kind of game with the Jank cast people more in person. It's close enough to where they all live. Yeah, so I do, professor of sociology.
Nice, very nice. So how has that your PhD in sociology and your areas of expertise, how have they affected how you talk about and design games?
That's a really good question. So I think in a couple ways. I mean, one thing is just, so we're going to talk about the game, a game I designed tonight called The Sword, the Crown, and the Unspeakable Power. And actually, my interest in politics and the sociology of politics has shaped that a little bit. I tend to think as a sociologist in terms of structures and power. That's a lot of what we talk about in sociology, is we think about how social structure shapes people's behavior, how social structure shapes people's ability to act. So on some level, the temptation in designing The Sword, the Crown, the Unspeakable Power was always putting in too much of that. Mm-hmm. And my co-designer, I should add, also has a PhD in sociology. So we had a tendency to like throw all this stuff in about power and about social structure and have people play test it and go, you could pull some of this out. But just to give you a quick example, we can talk more about this later when we talk about the game. But, you know, there's a mechanic in the game that's about kind of your reputation. Mm-hmm. For a long time, I just called it social capital, which is a sociology term. It's from a sociologist named Pierre Bourdieu. Bourdieu's idea of social capital is the idea that who you know and kind of what your standing is with them is a source of inequality and power in society. That someone who has a lot of powerful people in their social network, rich people, well-connected people in their social network, that person will have greater life chances and greater outcomes for their endeavors than someone who doesn't. You can kind of imagine someone trying to get a job, right? If you know, mm-hmm. you know, the CEO of a major corporation, you're more likely to get a job there than someone who doesn't. And we have a mechanic that we were trying to kind of use to make that kind of play just a little bit more subtly than that in our game. We eventually wound up calling it honor. But for a while, I was calling it social capital before deciding that was a little too academic ease for the game. I actually, If you know Kat Jones, who's another gamer and game designer, Kat Jones and I just recently recorded an episode of the Jankcast where we talked about sociology and gaming. So if people are interested in the like hour-long answer to this question as opposed to the 2-minute answer to this question, you can check out that cast. I was pretty proud of that, actually. I think it's something we've been kind of joking about for a while. Just as a fun story, Kat and I met at a sociology conference because we're both interested in the sociology of social movements. We were at a panel together, and we just started talking. And just like halfway through the conversation, like I just offhandedly mentioned that I was a gamer, and she's like, "What kind of games?" And I was like, "Well, you know, like Dungeons and Dragons." And I usually have to explain that to people. Mm-hmm. And she's like, "Well, like Dungeons and Dragons or like other role playing games?" I was like, "Well, right now I'm playing in an Apocalypse World game." And she was like, "Oh, I know Vincent Baker."
Yeah,
and there you go. We knew all the same people, and like, so we kind of had this weird, like, backdoor way into realizing each other were gamers. So yeah, we've been talking for years about doing a podcast on that, and finally got around to it.
I know that episode popped up. I just haven't had a chance to listen to it yet.
Yeah, yeah.
Is she from the New England area then?
Massachusetts area. I don't think she's not there anymore. But yeah, she was gaming with people out there for a while.
Fantastic. That means she probably knows Epi and Emily Karabas. And
oh, I think so. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think they live on the same block, Emily and Epi and Bakers. So
that's my impression. I've never been out there, but I've always kind of understood that there's this really dense area in kind of the like UMass, Massachusetts area where there's a whole bunch of gamers who all live within a couple blocks of each other.
Yep.
I remember talking to like Rob Bowl when he lived out there, I think for a while, and he was talking about the people who lived out there and just me being like, wow, how did everyone wind up in this like couple mile radius where they can all game together all the time?
I don't know. It's really weird because when I went to PAX East a bunch of years ago, they were all there because, you know, it's right. It's like their backyard. So
yeah, yeah, exactly.
I could actually just chat about that for a while, but moving on, you came to the Jankcast later in its time as a show.
Yeah, yeah.
What was Jank when you joined, and where do you think it's evolved to from there?
I came in around episode 30. We're on episode 200-something now. I think we just put out like 220, 225, something like that. So it was started by Lex and John Kelly. The only person who's an original cast member who's still on is Scott. But Timo joined pretty early. And when it started, Lex and John Kelly really wanted a very free-form cast. They wanted a kind of loud and opinionated cast, like by their own admission. Lex always used to say that he really hated NPR voice. And I don't know if anyone listening to this right now can tell or not, but I kind of have NPR voice.
I've always thought you had NPR voice.
Yeah, so I think they wish I would have yelled more. But what happened is, the way John Kelly ran the cast was he had a tendency to just kind of go, anyone who wants can come on. So I was around one day at the store. They ran it out of Chicagoland Games, which is a great game store. It's obviously still there. If you're in Chicago, go to Chicagoland Games. Lex still runs it. So I was just around there. Hey, be on the podcast. I knew all the guys from hanging out at the store. And I was on it. And then if John Kelly liked you or thought you said something interesting, he'd ask you back. So I was on. I got asked back. I was on. I got asked back. And then I pointed out to John Kelly that I had a little bit of experience with sound recording and things like that, just because I played in bands for a long time and I used to record bands. And he was like, oh, do you want to edit the cast? So I said, sure. And that's kind of how I weaseled my way into becoming a ongoing member of the cast, is I offered to edit.
Do the thing that we all like love to do.
So I started editing it. I started writing music for it. And then the other person who joined right around then was Megan. Megan joined around episode 40. And Megan actually joined in part because there was something, she can tell the story better than I can, but she was on just like a brief episode where she like said one or two quick things that they pre-recorded, and then everyone really liked it. So we started having Megan on more frequently. And Lex and John Kelly both just kind of got tired of it and dropped off. And then it was predominantly for a long time, me, Megan, Scott, and Timo. Scott is in China half the year, so he can't always do the cast, and Timo's very busy with work, so we eventually brought on our friends Joe and Jen, who can be on more frequently. But those are the kind of six core hosts. Usually on any given cast, there will be about three of us on, three to four of us on. And how has it changed? I mean, for one thing, it's lost a little bit of the kind of, it's in some ways become quieter and more academic. It started out with John Kelly and Lex trying to actively avoid that. There was a lot of kind of, it was very, like I said, it was very opinionated. They wanted to kind of yell. They wanted to be kind of a very boisterous, fighty cast where like you'd kind of tune in and hear friends kind of fighting about games.
Mm-hmm.
As Lex and John Kelly kind of got tired of it and dropped off, Timo, myself, Joe, Jen, we are not yelly fighty people. Megan can be, but nah, like she kind of goes with the flow. So we mostly kind of are more interested in things like game theory. We're more interested in having designers on to talk about the kind of stuff they do. I think in some ways that makes sense, because when we started doing the cast, you know, we were all, John Kelly was 17 when he started the cast. You know, I was in my mid-20s when the cast started. You know, it's kind of grown up a little bit with us in some ways. It's gone from being a cast by a bunch of kind of punk kids to a cast that's now with people who are literally approaching middle age, you know, people who are having children and, you know, have adult responsibilities and jobs and have grown up a little bit. And I think the tone and tenor of the cast kind of reflects that. I think we've gotten interested in somewhat more adult topics in gaming. I think we've kind of, the tone of it has kind of grown up with us a bit. And I'm pretty proud of our body of work. And I think I'm pretty proud of the direction it's gone. So I like I said, we're on episode 220 something, and I hope we can keep doing it indefinitely. I think we're all pretty committed to continue to do it, especially now that I'll be close to folks again.
Yeah, Cenk has been a podcast mainstay since from when I started listening to podcasts to starting to getting into. I mean, I think it's as old, if not a little older, than Misdirected Mark.
Yeah, that's I think so. Yeah, I think we've been going about the same amount of time. And yeah, it's funny to think that, because like in my head, it's just a thing I do that I love doing and that I have fun doing. So I don't think of it as like, we've been around forever. We have this, but you know, I was just talking to Jason from the Gauntlet, and he was saying like, you know, when I got back into gaming, you guys were one of the first podcasts I listened to. And I listened and I was like, wow, we have been around that long, haven't we? And now meeting people who are like, oh, I, you know, Janecast influenced the way I play or got me back into gaming. It's kind of cool and humbling, because I had those podcasts and I had those blogs and I had those, whatever it was, those people, those books that I read, where when I was getting back into gaming after an extended hiatus in my early 20s, I found podcasts or other gamers or writers on gaming who just really made it come alive for me. So I, you know, I just, we are part of the just ongoing conversation of gaming in a way that I'm very happy to be a part of.
I love being there too. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you, is because, you know, I'm a fan of the Jankcast, and I thought it'd be fun to talk to a fellow podcaster, especially because you have this game and we love Powered by the Apocalypse games. In fact, let's talk a little bit about Wheel Tree Press, because you publish games such as Time Chalice, where you travel through time as a bunch of kids to stop a supervillain from taking over the world. And you're basically, I mean, it doesn't have to, but it seems like it's like the Yo-Yo Ma, Doctor Who type game.
It is. Yeah. It actually started because it came from a complete joke. I don't even remember what game we were playing, but we were kind of playing a game and we were kind of getting loopy. And somehow Megan and I came up with, you know what it was? We were listening to, while we played a game, we had a soundtrack going and it was like a cello based band. And somehow this led to us coming up with this idea of a time traveling superhero that plays cello, basically. And we started calling this person Time Cellist. And you know, Megan and I had talked about designing a game for a get-together for a long time. We'd done the cast for a long time. Megan's one of my closest friends. And this just somehow took over our minds. we got like halfway through designing the game, and it was kind of like, this is a thing that's happening. Let's keep going. And we started talking about it on the cast, and people started doing artwork for it. People, without even asking, we just started getting drawings in the mail of Time Chalice and things like that. So we kickstarted it. To our surprise, it funded. We decided to kind of make it a bit of a kid's game, almost. Paper, Rock, Scissors is the main mechanic. It uses a cootie catcher. It uses Slapjack. We kind of picked kids' games to do it. And yeah, you play as a group of kids who are helping out a time-traveling superhero to basically to stop an army of ninjas and supervillains from changing history too much. Yeah, that's Time Chalice. And that was the first game we did. Then Megan and her partner Eric designed a card game called Greenlight. That's kind of a party card game.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the two things we've put out so far as Wheel Tree Press.
Well, now you're kickstarting Scup, the Sword, the Crown, and the Unspeakable Power, which is a game that focuses on power, intrigue, and shifting alliances in a dark fantasy setting. One of the things that I caught was you have a collaborative mythology and setting building tools. And
yes,
it's also powered by the Apocalypse. Now, At Mr. Ectomark Productions, we don't feel that Powered by the Apocalypse is a game engine, but a design aesthetic. So I'm curious.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious as to how you interpreted the aesthetics of the ideas presented in Powered by the Apocalypse games to create mechanics which help reinforce your design goals. Or, if you want the simple version, it's what are you doing with the game to create the feel you're looking for in play?
I like that. So, SCUP started really simply, which was that Tom, my friend Tom and I, both kind of liked A Song of Ice and Fire. We both liked the First Law series. And we were both, like I said, sociologists. We were in grad school at the time together, and we were talking about inequality and power. We had just played a game, a campaign of Apocalypse World, and we were like, Apocalypse World does that pretty well. Like, there's kind of good moves in there for, like, thinking about spying on people and intrigue and, like, domination and power and hierarchy. It's not obviously the crux of the game, but we kind of saw it in there that, like, you know, you have the hard holder and you have all this stuff that you could use to kind of imagine how that would work. So we just kind of looked at each other and like, what if it was like Apocalypse World, but with swords? Mm-hmm. Like, that's what we want, right? Like that, but with swords. So we started designing this game. It's about 5 or 6 years ago. And at first it was just us and our friends basically playing medieval Apocalypse World and kind of making it up as we went along. It was kind of like if someone did something cool or wanted to do something cool, we would kind of come up with something on the fly. And then the next day, Tom and I would kind of write down ideas and bat them back and forth and email them back and forth. And eventually, it sort of turned into a game on its own. Hmm. We've been spending years kind of tweaking it until we decided it was kind of ready for consumption. So what I think Powered by the Apocalypse does that works here is, and I've talked about this a little bit on the Jankcast, Powered by the Apocalypse, I think, does an interesting thing in that it's a what I would call a high-information game, in that there's a lot of tools for players to gain information about other characters, about the setting. You can think of a move like Read a Person. And Read a Person is interesting in that, you know, you can quite literally, you know, historically in role-playing games, I played so many games where it was a mystery who the bad guy was. And, you know, as a player, you were constantly running around trying to mind-read the GM's characters to figure out who was who. And Apocalypse World just does away with all that. It says, you're going to find out who's who. You make a read-a-person role, and if you get it, you find out who what they're thinking about you, and you can act on it then. And we actually thought that that was kind of interesting for a game about intrigue, because what I think is important for intrigue is the ability to spread around information. Like, intrigue is about kind of knowing things about people, spying on people, hearing whispers and rumors. So one of the things we tried to do with the Sword of the Crown, the Unspeakable Power, which from here on out I'll call SCUP, which is kind of our abbreviation for it. One of the things we tried to do with SCUP was make a lot of moves about information gathering, information spreading. So there are characters who can spread rumors. There are characters who, you know, one character, the voice and the liar, both have moves to kind of spread rumors among crowds or cover their tracks as they do so. So they can either rile a crowd up with a rumor or they can undermine someone by spreading information about them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of characters, including the voice and the screw, have extra powerful moves for gathering information on people. The screw can kind of gain people's secrets if they have access to them. The liar can spy on people. I just did a playtest where someone was playing as the liar, and they were able to use some of their moves to kind of gather information on someone. So to give you a quick example of what it looked like in practice, the person had a ruler they wanted to undermine. So they wanted to try to figure out who might be someone that they could target to undermine them, who might also not be on their side. So they sent out their kind of network of spies to figure out who might be someone they could ally with in undermining this ruler. And they were successful in doing that, and they found people they could partner with to do that. Mm. So one thing we did was we looked at Apocalypse World and said, it spreads information around well. It gives players a lot of information. It doesn't withhold information from them. We really like that. Let's push that to the front of the game. Let's make the spread and gathering of information important. You think of something like Game of Thrones, right? And you think of like a character like Littlefinger, or you think of a character like Glockta in the First Law series. And they are characters that are all about information. They know things about people. They can share things about people. They can spread rumors about people. We wanted to really mechanize that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of goes to a second part of our design aesthetic for SCUP, is that Apocalypse World is really good, and Powered by the Apocalypse games are really good at kind of giving characters different ways to be awesome and to be powerful. So the game is called The Sword, the Crown, the Unspeakable Power for a reason. Those are three ways that someone is powerful in the game.
Ah, that makes sense.
on the one hand, someone is powerful because they have a crown. They have some kind of power, authority. So you can play the king, the ruler in our game. You can play a prophet. You can be someone, you can play the commander of a militia. You can play someone in SCUP who has some kind of actual authority over people. Or you can play the sword. There's a character called the Gauntlet who is powerful. There's another character who was a powerful kind of magic user who can harm people with their magic. Or conversely, you can draw on the unspeakable power, something that is beyond human comprehension. Can you kind of draw on dark powers or draw on mystical powers? So we're trying to think of different ways that character classes could wield and have power in a fantasy setting. Authority through a title, through a power, a skill. Authority through the ability to put their sword through someone. Authority because of something beyond our comprehension, beyond this world. And we've really designed each of the playbooks towards having some kind of ability to gain power through what they have. I think all that is in Apocalypse World. We actually kept a lot of the core of Apocalypse World very similar and then redesigned a lot of the stuff on the edges to really push forward this idea of power and hierarchy and information and how all that stuff comes to factor into the characters' lives.
So it sounds like the flow of the game is about gathering information and then using information to make things happen, which then goes back to gathering information, which then goes back to using information to make things happen.
There's a lot of conniving. Yeah. It's like the ideal session of SCUP, I find, tends to be a lot of players looking around the table going, I want to know more about that. I want to know more about that person. How can I undermine that person? How can I figure out what's going on with that person? So there's a fair amount of kind of spying, information gathering before people start to usually then use that information, use that knowledge to start to make the axe come down, basically.
You know, to put Eddard Stark on the chopping block, as they say.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the things we did is try to mechanize exactly that. I've talked about this a little bit elsewhere. We have what we call end-of-season moves because, you know, we're kind of thinking of the TV version of Game of Thrones where usually episode 9 or so, they have some big event happen, you know, Ned Stark, you know, the execution of Ned Stark or, you know, the Red Wedding. And we were kind of thinking, like, how do you mechanize that? So one of the things we came up with was, you know, we wanted to make sure, kind of once again, following the genre, and I think this works for Apocalypse World too, Apocalypse World is good at making big things happen in the fiction. So we created a lot of moves that allow big things to happen in the fiction. We're going to release some, you know, quick start documents for backers of the Kickstarter so people can see the moves we have. But we're pretty proud of a lot of the moves we've come up with. Just to give an off the top of my head example, the Gauntlet can declare if they die in battle that it's their last stand. If they reach their last bit of harm in battle, it's their last stand. And then they basically can fight until the battle is over. So the whole idea being that we wanted someone playing the Gauntlet, which is a big, powerful kind of tank sort of character, to be able to go out in a blaze of glory effectively if they were going to die in combat. That it wasn't going to be a thing where, you know, if they hit their last bit if their last hit point effectively, that they had to kind of stop fighting and just die, that they could kind of go out saying like, listen, I'm the Gauntlet, so I'm going to go out, you know, taking everyone with me. So one of the things we did was come up with these end of season moves where characters can take moves that allow, and the players take them. So if you take one as a player, you're saying like, you know what? I want to go out with a bang. I want a big thing to happen. I want everything to go wrong for me. I want something bad to happen to me. You are giving the MC permission to maybe after 8 or 9 sessions of playing a character, you're ready to move on. Like, how can we send this person out in the biggest way possible?
Hmm.
And some of those end of season moves we're pretty proud of. So I think, you know, even getting to the aesthetic of it, like that's one thing that we thought Apocalypse World does well is it kind of pushes big narrative shaping moves. And we really wanted to kind of take that and ramp that up to 11 to give that sort of Game of Thrones feel where big things happen in the fiction and let the players really get involved in big things happening in the fiction.
So you have these end of season moves. What do you have in the book that helps frame these seasons or these arcs of play? Is there anything in there or is it just when it feels right?
Good question. We have a way it's somewhat mechanized. Some of it is just when it feels right. You know, we kind of have a whole section on how to kind of think about character arcs and how to think about an arc of a season. And we have a little section that kind of says like, I mean, on the one hand, if people are getting bored, feel free to start ending the season. But we actually have a way it's mechanized, which is, so if you've played Apocalypse World, you know that there's kind of advancements you could take. We have that in our game as well. So, you know, you take a certain number of advancements in your first tier, then you unlock a second tier. Well, the end of season moves are going to be something that kind of unlocks when you start to make what are called advanced hits. Just like in Apocalypse World, you can advance basic moves in the game, and then you get more powerful versions of the basic moves. The end of season moves trigger when you make a certain number of advanced
hits.
That
makes sense.
So if you want a way to mechanize it, we kind of have it mathematically worked out that if, you know, people are kind of advancing at a normal rate, you'll start to kind of unlock your second tier around, you know, session 5, 6, 7. And then you'll start to, if you start to pick, you know, advance the basic moves, you'll start to make advanced hits. And eventually around, you know, session 8, 9, 10, someone's going to trigger an end of season move. So we have it mechanized a little bit, but we also say, you know, if it feels right, if you're on session 8 and you think it's just about done and you're ready to go out, this might be a time to kind of think about activating some of those moves. But really what we wanted to do was just give players permission to bring some of that stuff into the fiction. You know, I can kind of understand as an MC, you know, you might have a great idea for something to end kind of a campaign on, and, you know, that will really change the game if you ever pick it back up again. But, you know, it's kind of touchy to be like, you know, I'm just going to kill everyone around this character. I'm going to kill everyone this character loves, basically. Mm-hmm. But when the player picks a move that basically gives the MC permission to do that and kind of winks at them and says, look at this move I'm taking, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. It's a way to give the MC permission to say, like, listen, I know I want the blood opera. Give me the blood opera. That's what I want to go out on. So we thought it was a way we thought really hard about and thought it was important to put that in the player's hands to kind of give the player the button. You know, let the player have the button and then let the MC push it, basically. So they're kind of collaborating, because we didn't want something that just the MC dropped on the players without their permission. So the player kind of says, go ahead and hit me with this. And then the MC gets to decide what it looks like.
I really like that a lot. We just had Nathan Paletta on the show, and we were talking about episodic gaming. I know this isn't episodic gaming, yeah, but he had a lot of structures in a new game that he's got coming out for him for, like, how to time scenes with the mechanic that's in the game. So this is like a larger scaled version of that. Like, you don't have to use it, like you said. Like, you can opt in for some of those moves. But if you use the structure that you set up, after X amount of sessions, there should be so many advancements. So now the moves that are here, one or two of them will be picked by the players, and that is a cue for the MC to say that that's the thing that they want to happen to be, like, the season ending or the season shifting move. It's really,
exactly,
it's really cool. Like, it's, you can see the narrative arc in it. It's not completely locked in.
Yeah.
I love that, McKay. I'm going to steal that, by the way. So thanks.
Feel free.
The MC. Do you call it the MC in this game?
Yeah, we call it the MC.
What is the MC's agenda in this game?
Good question. So the MC's agenda in SCUP is to make the world feel epic and extraordinary, to fill the player characters' lives with intrigue and drama, and, as in Apocalypse World, play to find out what happens.
Mm-hmm. The follow-up to that is, one, you can completely expound upon that if you want to, but I was wondering if you could, when you're done with that, hit us with a couple of the GM moves which highlight that agenda.
Yes, absolutely. So really what we're going for in this game is, like I said, we want it to feel big. We want it to feel like the characters are at the center of something monumental. When I run a one-shot of this game, this is just what I did over the weekend when I ran a one-shot at Forge. I often like to have it at something like, if we're going to have a one or two-shot, at like a giant festival or a feast or a wedding or a funeral. I like to have it at an event. So this one was, you know, we had this kind of Mesopotamian-themed fantasy world where there's this great ziggurat in the middle of the city. And we set it at a festival where every year the whole town gathers, and, like, the high priestess of the city demands a sacrifice. And that person has to wander into the desert, and the gates of the city are locked behind them. And everyone was like, cool, we're in. Like, yes, let's do this. And I like to do that because it allows for this sort of big epic quality, right? That, like, all the big final confrontations of the setting of the session take place in front of the whole city at this festival. And the MC's agenda, fill the player characters' lives with intrigue and drama. It's really the MC's job in this game to surround the characters with innuendo, with rumors, to kind of keep people always guessing at who is on their side and who's not. So if we want to think about the MC moves, we actually worked a lot on the MC moves in this game. And the MC has way more moves in this game than in most PBTA games that we've seen.
As long as it's not as many as in Masks.
Yeah, it's not. No, Masks has more.
Thanks. I appreciate that, because I'm having a hard time managing that.
No, actually what we did is keep them all on one sheet. So we actually don't have any for, like Masks have a lot of, has them for different, like, kind of character threats and things like that. We just kind of kept them all on one sheet. They're kind of broken into four categories. So on the one hand, we have basic MC moves, So some of the basic MC moves, like one of them is give word of whisperings behind their back, or align a faction's agenda against them. Disgrace them privately or publicly. Mm-hmm. These are things that are trying to like get at the hierarchy of the game, the intrigue of the game. But one of the things we did is to try to bring this idea of kind of intrigue and hierarchy alive was to give the MC different moves to use against elite and common characters, by which we mean characters who are kind of part of the power elite of the city. Are you part of a noble family? Do you work for, you know, the temple or something like that, something that would make you connected to power? So for elite characters, we have moves that are MC moves that are like force their hand and make them wield their power. Show them how far they could fall, hint at vast conspiracies against them, challenge their position with insubordination. Whereas for common characters, characters who are kind of everyday folk living out on the streets, you know, locked out of power, we have things like show them how much they stand to gain, subtly remind them of their lot in life, crush them with debt to those who have everything, put them in their place with degradation and humiliation. So we're trying to drive home this idea that people experience the world very differently in a hierarchical system. Those at the bottom of the system experience the world in one way. Those at the top of the system experience it in another way. We have a couple other moves that rely on this as well. Things about like refusing a duty or a debt that you owe someone. Additionally, we gave the MC moves to use with the unspeakable power. One of the things that we've kind of focused on, and this is something that Tom is very into. Tom is very into like Lovecraftian horror, my co-designer Tom. Mm-hmm. He really made it clear that he wants the unspeakable power to, in any game that people play, to have a personality and an agenda. So the MC moves for using the unspeakable power are things like give them what they think they want, make a demand and set a price on failure, seduce them with promises of hedonistic pleasure, mm-hmm. reveal to them the depths of their ignorance. We really wanted the unspeakable power to be a thing that grants its users unspeakable power, that grants its users a great degree of leeway to do what they want, but that failure and that using it in general comes with a price. It's something that the power that gives it to you will want to make demands of you, will want to push you, will want to use you in some way. To give another example, this almost everyone who's a magic user in this game, almost all the magic using classes, have some kind of move that does something that allows the power to get their clutches on them. So, for example, if you're an adept who is a wizard in this game, the adept has a magical item they could use, but it's possible that the magical item may make demands of them when they use it. It's possible the magical item may need to be convinced to do what the adept wants. You can talk to it as if it's an NPC. So we kind of tried to make magic this thing that has both power to it, but also interesting narrative conditions for failure. That if you fail, it's not just your magic doesn't happen. It's more like, well, now the unspeakable power is interested in you. Now it wants to know why you're using it. Now it wants to know, can you be friends? Can the unspeakable power give you a job? Mm-hmm. So once again, trying to highlight this thing about power, about drama, about the world being epic and extraordinary. We didn't want magic to just be a thing that you snap your fingers and it happens. Rather, it's this thing that permeates every aspect of the world that gives the people who use it both great power and also kind of terrible responsibilities that they have to live up to.
Magic sounds awesome because I imagine you could probably tune it up or tune it down if you wanted to too, because it can be like Melisandre and such in Game of Thrones, which magic is always on the edges of everything, but it's present.
Yes, yeah.
Or you could, and like, you know, the dragons and all that good stuff. And the Logan Ninefingers, the First Law book, there's not so much magic in that book.
Exactly, yeah. Like you were saying before, we have a world creation system for the game where characters design a mythology, like literally sit and design the foundational mythology of their world. And one of the things you're supposed to do in that is figure out what the source of magic is and what magic means. So you could design a world where magic is considered dangerous, so it's outlawed. Mm-hmm. Maybe only the elites have access to magic. Mm-hmm. Or you could design a world where magic is everywhere. Like any one random person walking down the street could be using magic in some way. It's kind of up to you, and it's going to set the tone and flavor for magic in your world, what it means to be a magic user, how many magic users there are. In the game I just ran over the weekend, magic was locked away. It was literally magic came from these tablets that were found in a cave that were locked beneath the ziggurat. And one of the characters decided that he was part of essentially an outlaw group that tried to steal the words on the ziggurats by, you know, tracking down people who knew them and, like, kind of beating it out of them, basically, in an effort to make magic more available to the common people. So whatever you come up with in your game, you know, like you said, tune it up, tune it down. Magic can be everywhere, or it could be this thing that only the elites or only a certain class of people have access to. That's something that's very intentional in the game. We want it to kind of be whatever you think would be fun to play with regard to the setting of your game.
So the collaborative mythology and setting building, is that a series of questions that get asked that you answer, or how does that work?
So what it is we broke myths into their component parts. Tom and I did. We talked a bunch about this. And we were kind of like, what, like, if you just boiled a myth down to like a foundational myth down to its essentials, what would it be? So it's kind of, yeah, a series of questions like, in the beginning, what was there? Then what happened? Then what happened? And there's kind of lists you pick from to design your myth. And along the way, then we ask questions like, what did that look like? What does it mean? We provide evocative images and ideas that the players can draw on as they create it. It's a lot of fun to do the myths. This is one of the things there's been some people who have actually play tested the game and used the myths and said they just took the myths to the myth generation system and used it for other games they were playing because they liked it. So we've been pretty proud of that. Like it's kind of quick. It takes about 20 minutes. And part of the idea that we talk about in the book is, you know, if you create a myth, there's a lot of meat to a myth, right? Because it tells you things about the world. It tells you a little bit of history about the world. It tells you what magic is in the world. But it also tells you, like, what the values of people in the world are, right?
Yeah, very true.
Like, is your myth about warriors that fight off a great evil, a great monster, a great dragon? Or is your myth about scholars who grow their knowledge and use their knowledge to do something good in the world, to save people from some catastrophe? That's going to tell you a little bit about what people value in your world and who's in charge of your world. Is your world militaristic? Is your world, you know, some kind of oligarchy, a technocracy? So that's kind of some of the questions that we ask along the way. Like, if this is what you say in your myth, who does that mean is in charge? Who does that mean is powerful? What values are respected? And then what does this tell you about people in your society?
Yeah, what are people afraid of? What does their culture look like? All right, I have a couple more questions about the game. Really just one, I guess. So you mentioned the class system, how there are the people who are in the inside of power and the outside of power. How do you make it so that if people play playbooks from different sides of that, they mesh together?
It's pretty easy to establish linkages between characters. I mean, first off, like a lot of PBTA games, characters establish relationships at the beginning of the game. So you'll establish relationships with other characters. Another thing is that characters have what are called patrons. So a lot of the character classes, particularly some of the less powerful character classes, might literally point to someone else at the table and say, you're my patron. Mm. So let's say someone is playing the crown, who is the splat that is the ruler, you know, the king, the queen, the emperor. And then someone's playing the lyre, L-Y-R-E, which is like a harp, which is the person who's the bard, the actor, the entertainer, the comedian. Well, the lyre can have a patron. The lyre could point to the crown and say, I work for you. And then they can work out exactly how they're together. So sure, the lyre is common. They're not noble. They're typically going to be a common character, someone from, you know, kind of a rough background. But maybe the emperor saw them perform somewhere and said, I'm going to take you into my palace and you're going to be my court performer. You're going to be my court poet or my court musician. So there's built into the playbooks ways that the characters kind of create webs of interaction, right? They know each other. They have connections to each other. They might work for each other that kind of give them into that. In fact, that was one of the things that in this playtest we just did. You know, one of the characters worked for the ruler. She was the advisor to the high priestess, effectively, of the city. And that was kind of her into that. The other thing is, one of the things that we make a big deal of saying in the book is, it doesn't matter if your character is the king, if your the player character is the king or is the lowliest peasant in town, because they are the PC, the game is about them. So whoever your characters are, like, the job of the MC on some level, and we give them some tools to do this, is to bring the characters together and give them, once again, make their lives feel epic and extraordinary. And even the people who are playing, you know, more common characters have moves that allow them to kind of shape the narrative and do extraordinary things. So the lyre, once again, you know, lyre is kind of a poet, an actor, a comedian, a bard. Well, one of their moves is to rile a crowd against people in power, right? One of the things we talked about for the lyre is we kind of said the lyre is like Occupy Wall Street. it's not just someone who plays music. It's not just someone who's pretty. It's not just someone who can play a song that like gives you a buff, but like the liar is the person who speaks truth to power. So they have some moves that allow them to do things like that. We wanted to be someone who could kind of mock the high and mighty, who could do things like that. And that's one way we kind of tried to, and same with the Beloved. The Beloved is the character who's the prophet, and they have similar moves as well that allow them to kind of challenge authority, to perhaps lead a group of people against the rulers of their particular setting. So we wanted to make sure that even if you were playing a common character, you had A, tangible connections to the people in power that you could start the game with, and B, moves that allowed you to affect the lives of people in power. You could lead people against them, you could stir people against them, you could stir up animosity against the ruler, things like that.
So, just in general, is there a move that's called Rabble Rouser? Because it feels like there should be a move called Rabble Rouser.
There isn't. I can tell you what it's called. It's called Vox Populi.
Oh, that's good, too. That's actually really good.
We've toyed around with the names of the moves a lot. Now, that particular move for the liar is called Vox Populi.
All right. So that's the game. Is there anything that you wanted to touch on before I get to the Kickstarter?
No, I think it's good. Let's talk about it.
Real quick, everybody out there, for $10, you can get the PDF. For $25, you can get the PDF plus soft cover, or $40 if you want the PDF and the hardcover.
Yeah.
I would say, what is the cool thing that you can get? But the cool thing that you can get is sold out, because there's a sword that you can buy for $500, but they're all sold out.
Tom has a theory that someone who bought that is a friend of ours under an assumed name.
Yeah.
And he's just going to show up at Tom's house, because it's the kind of friend who would do something, that he's going to show up at Tom's house carrying the sword once he gets it.
That seems about right.
Yeah, we were pretty impressed when that happened. What we're going to do pretty soon is probably open up a few new items people could buy that might have to do with the art, or might have to do with we're definitely going to open up some retailer tiers.
Nice.
We've gotten a few people who have requested that. So yeah, be on the lookout for that in the near future.
Because right now, unless you have any more stretch goals planned, you've hit them all.
We hit all our stretch goals. Yeah, our stretch goals had to do with getting an artist that we love to do the artwork, who I'm very excited about. Her name is Marnie Galloway. She used to do art for my old band. I've played in a bunch of metal bands. And she used to do art for my band. And she has been like my dream artist for SCUP.
She's an award-winning cartoonist and illustrator, so.
Yeah, her comic book, In the Sounds and the Seas, is unbelievable, and she does these amazing abstract backgrounds, and that I've always envisioned since like day one of SCUP. I've always envisioned that being kind of the way the playbooks looked and the way the books looked. I was always worried that she was going to be like, no, that's kind of my thing, I use that for the Sounds of the Seas, you know, because I've asked her a couple times if she'd be interested in SCUP, and she was always kind of like, yeah. And then we started really talking about ideas, like we were just bouncing ideas off each other. I was just talking to her on the phone last week about them, and just I can just picture some of the stuff she's describing. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be cool. So I'm excited about that. And then at 12,000, which we just hit, it's extra playbooks. Tom, myself, and Jen from the Jankcast, who also has been kind of collaborating on stuff for Wheeltree and is a designer herself. Jen, Tom, and I are going to design 5 kind of experimental playbooks. Jen previewed 2 of them in an update. We actually have a stretch goal lined up, and that we're probably going to do at 15, that I'll reveal very, very soon. I don't want to say too much about it, just in case it falls through, but I'm pretty sure we've got it set. To tease it just a little bit, I don't know when this will be out exactly, but so it might be out after it drops. The idea we really wanted to do is we don't just want people to default inherently to doing medieval European fantasy, like medieval Western European fantasy. We wanted something that could help give people tools to think about doing SCUP in different settings, you know, Asian settings, you know, basically non-European fantasy settings.
Maybe some cyberpunk?
If you want to try doing cyberpunk, we were thinking of more like various other kinds of historical fantasy settings, but okay. I could totally imagine a version of this that's cyberpunk. If we can come up with something for that, that'd be really interesting. But yeah, we want to give people some tools to think of like fantasy in different cultures, effectively. So that's what our next stretch goal is going to be. And then we do have something that we're toying around with after that, if we hit that, which will be maybe something to help people think about the genre of dark fantasy a little bit. Mm-hmm. That's about as far out as we've planned. If we hit that, then we have no idea what we're doing. So we'll see if that happens.
That's all I had to say. I just wanted to mention, we're fans of Nathan Paletta, and he's your graphic designer.
He is, yeah. He's going to do the layout of the game. Nathan is amazing by everything Nathan ever does. But Nathan also did the design for Time Charleston, did just an amazing job. He is an amazing person, an amazing game designer, and a delight to work with. So, yeah, we're very excited to have Nathan on board.
And a ton of fun to talk to. He was just on the most recent episode, so.
Oh, God, he's great. Yeah, we love having him on the cast. I could sit and talk to Nathan about kind of game design stuff all day. He's just got such a good mind for it.
So is there anything else you'd like to say about the Kickstarter or SCUP that I might have missed?
No, I think that's good. I think if you haven't yet, go check out the page for the Kickstarter. Other than that, I think I'm pretty happy.
Nice. I'll have links in the show notes for many of the things that we talked about here. Todd, thank you so much for joining us in the lounge, and congratulations on the success of the Kickstarter so far, and I hope it goes better in the future.
Thanks. I really appreciate it.